Welcome to the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, a podcast from the Berlin-based Think and Do Tank Adelphi, bringing you the latest insights and debates in international climate diplomacy and security. We are your hosts, Raquel Monayer.
And I'm Alexandra Steinkraus. In this series, you will hear from experts and practitioners offering their take on climate foreign policy, climate-related impacts to security, and promoting peace and resilience in a changing climate. For more information, please visit climate-diplomacy.org or follow at climatediplo on Twitter.
A warm welcome to our listeners and thank you for joining us. In this episode, we will talk about the environment in a context of war and conflict. And if you listen to us regularly, you will remember that we recently had a guest in our podcast speaking to us about how the war in Syria has devastated the local nature and resources and is leaving a trail of destruction that will be carried through generations. Today, we will continue this conversation, but looking at it from an angle of accountability. Can states or leaders be made accountable for the environmental destruction it caused when waging war? That's a tricky question.
Our guest today, and the person who will try to give us a clue as to whether this is possible, is Philippa Nuttall. She's a freelance writer, editor, and commenter focused on climate change, the clean energy transition, sustainable development, and the environment. She has written the article, How Vladimir Putin Weaponized the Environment in Ukraine, for the magazine The New Statesman, and also many other articles looking into a myriad of issues pertaining to the geopolitics of climate and environmental change. Welcome, Philippa.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, Philippa, how did Putin weaponize the environment in its war on Ukraine?
Yeah, thanks. So I think perhaps just first of all to make clear that when we talk about the environment in this context, we're talking about nature, but we're also talking more widely about the environment and the impact that certain actions can have on the environment. So in terms of contamination from chemicals factories, for example, from power stations into water. And the idea of weaponizing the environment and Vladimir Putin's actions in Ukraine go back as far as 2014, when Moscow invaded the Donbass, which, as your listeners will know, is a very heavily industrialized region where pollution was already a problem. There are various old coal mines in the region, and the coal mines must be pumped out regularly to prevent flooding and water contamination. Obviously, with the bombing, there are electricity supply cuts, which can therefore prevent this from happening. And so there are lots of fears that heavy metals are contaminating water supplies and the soil. So none of this is particularly new. And then obviously since Russia's invasion of Ukraine on the 24th of February this year, we've seen various actions in terms of attacks on the power stations. There's been the bombings around the nuclear power stations. There's been various attacks on industrial sites. And then also just the very fact of a war and the pollution which is emitted, which then has an impact on the local environment and on nature itself.
Looking closer at the natural environment and nature, I think a lot of people don't realize the importance of Ukraine as a migration and nesting spot for several bird species. So if we look closer at a specific example, could you tell us a little bit about the Emerald Network?
Sure, yeah. So the Emerald Network is a pan-European set of protected sites. And these sites are protected because there are certain species of flora and fauna that are there which are not found elsewhere or which is particularly protected. For example, there's the marble polecat, which is found in certain of Ukraine's sites, which is quite rare in the rest of Europe. And the Emerald Network in particular is home to Ukraine's wetlands, which are protected under the International Ramsar Convention. And wetlands are some of the world's most threatened ecosystems in Europe as well. And then in Ukraine, there have been active battles in certain of these sites, which are home to various animals, certain species of flowers, and now which have seen battles, you know, tanks going over them. And so therefore, this obviously has a significant impact on these places.
Expanding the question a little bit, when it comes to active battles in these sites and intentional environmental degradation, if we look at overarching concepts like eco-war, do you think that there is such a thing as an eco-war? And have you seen this as a rising trend in your research and journalism?
The United Nations certainly thinks it's possible to to wage an eco war. And at the moment, the UN and its members are finalizing 28 principles based on existing international law, which should be agreed this autumn. I mean, it's taken 10 years of consultation with more than 40 experts to draw up these principles. So it's been a very difficult process. And obviously, the idea that you can wage a war and protect the environment at the same time, it is extremely complicated. The guidelines are intended to reduce the ecological destructiveness of war and set out not just how countries behave during conflict, but also before and after, so that if there is destruction caused, then what happens afterwards. And many of the people, the negotiators who've worked on this say, you know, this should be the we're in a climate and biodiversity crisis, and therefore, even during war, we can't ignore what we're doing to nature and the wider environment. As to whether this is a trend or something, I mean, I'm not sure at the moment that we can specifically point to an example whereby a war has been fought and the environment protected at the same time. So it's something we should perhaps look at going forward. We can see after certain wars, such as the Iraq war, that committees were put in place to try and force the invaders to pay compensation and therefore try and repair the damage that was caused. But that was obviously afterwards rather than actually during conflict.
You started talking about environmental law already, and we know that environmental law, it provides us internationally recognized instruments, which at this point, and after all these years of discussions, is starting to make clear that reparations for environmental damage that happened in the context of war and conflict must be carried out by the perpetrator. And now we're looking at things from the perspective of being in the lead up to COP27, and everyone is talking about loss and damage quite a lot in the climate community, but in a completely different context, because it talks about reparations for victims of climate change impacts, mostly on the disaster side. So just to see, do you see synergies between these two issues in terms of reparations? And do you think that an environmental law angle might help the climate community move forward with the loss and damage discussion by providing this precedent from this particular perspective? Or do you believe they should be dealt with separately as they are right now?
Yeah, I think that's a really interesting question. I think they probably should be dealt with separately because I think they're two very different issues. When we're talking about war and the destruction caused during war, it's a very specific event that has caused that. Whereas when we're talking about loss and damage, we're talking about historical emissions. We're talking about the damage that has been caused by the processes of industrialization in Western countries, which goes back a long, long time, and it's not a single event. I think there's also a lot of concern, I mean, in terms of climate finance more generally, so there's the issue of loss and damage, which is paying for the historical emissions, but there's also the question of climate finance more generally in terms of helping poorer nations mitigate against climate change in terms of, for example, building out their renewable energy systems instead of relying on fossil fuels. And countries pledged back in 2009 to give $100 billion a year by 2020, which is still not happening. And there's lots of concern around that, that countries are already using general budgets for overseas development aid or more general money for environmental projects in countries as climate finance. And I think if we were to start then talk about more general environmental compensation or link it potentially to war or other aspects, you could then make it perhaps even easier for countries to say we've paid the climate finance when actually the budgets are being sort of used perhaps rather thinly for several different aspects. And I think it's very clear, especially in terms of the transparency that Western countries need to have towards poorer nations, that it's very clear that climate finance, loss and damage are paid in full as these countries have already pledged and that it's not confused with other issues.
Absolutely. And I guess the issue is not just having the law, but also being able to enforce it and to make perpetrators accountable. I mean, from what you were explaining right now, it's already difficult to get countries to accept their historic responsibility. And when we move into countries that are waging war actively and there are leaders that are choosing war as a path to further their interests, we can argue that they're not necessarily going to be particularly moved or interested in following international law or any other diplomatic instrument for that matter.
Yeah, I mean, totally. And I think part of this is also a question of defining what we're actually talking about. So, for example, certain lawyers have suggested that it would be possible to bring a case against Russia on the grounds of ecocide, which is taken to mean the widespread or long-term harm to nature. But such a concept is not yet enshrined in international law. So whereas various countries can include it in legislation, it's not an internationally defined concept. And we come up against a bit a similar issue in terms of climate finance, that the way different countries define climate finance, how they account for it, varies from country to country because there isn't a defined way of doing it. And there was some research came out of Germany, I think last week, which made this point very clearly. And the research had used artificial intelligence to use machine learning to actually sort of go through all the climate finance from different member states. And it's this question of how do you actually measure it when nothing is clearly defined and the accounting measures are not clearly defined. So this is obviously, you know, in answer to your question, a problem that is constantly come up against. If we don't have clear definitions, how then do you actually bring perpetrators to justice in a way? Because there's a very fine line of what's actually in law and what's not.
Of holding governments accountable and how international law can be used, we've also seen another trend of a lot of citizen-led climate suits that have been on the rise from all over the world, the Netherlands, Belgium, even here in Germany on the basis of air pollution very recently. Do you see the terms ecocide or eco-war playing a role in these grassroots movements or being incorporated into their claims in order to try to make governments more liable for their role in climate change and environmental degradation?
Yeah, I mean, we're seeing a lot more citizen-led climate suits, as you said, and I think this is clearly going to be a strong path moving forward, a way that citizens can hold governments and companies to account. We saw the case of Shell in the Netherlands and the cases led there where it's very clear to show that the government has not delivered what it promised it would do in terms of reducing emissions. But again, in terms of the terms that are used, obviously, if these are court cases, they need to be on a legal basis. And as I said before, ecocide isn't in international law. And for specific countries, it could be a term that could be used, but that wouldn't be relevant for every country, given that, you know, ecocide isn't in everybody's national law. And obviously, on a sort of higher level, in terms of, as I mentioned before, after the Iraq war, there was a UN compensation commission was set up to help neighboring states recover from the losses that had been inflicted and to repair environmental damage. But obviously, Russia is part of the UN Security Council, so it would have to be in favour of such a committee against itself. So these are also issues on an international basis that we're coming up against, is whether the international organisations that are in place today are still fit for purpose to deal with the challenges that we're facing. And I think that's one of the questions that's also being asked as of the COP process as well, is how much that is also leading action on climate change and actually being able to force countries almost to deliver. I mean, we heard from Greta Thunberg at COP26 last year, who just said it was blah, blah, blah. And while that there was some movement forward, it's very difficult. There are very few mechanisms to hold countries to account to actually force them to deliver on the emissions reductions, for example, that they've said they will put in place. So I think, as you said, yeah, to come back to your question, that at a national level, citizens' court cases is a strong way to go based on the law of those countries.
If we look at another additional level, even going from governments to citizen-driven initiatives, but do you see in terms of these terms, when it comes to terms like ecocide, do you see much sway within public opinion? So even if it's not like a legal mechanism that can be used at the moment, do we see kind of audience costs when we use these bigger terms?
I think terms like ecocide are still probably, they're still seen as quite extreme and probably only really understood by a small swathe of the public. And I think for the public, what they see is what you mentioned in your previous question is very concrete issues like emissions reductions or air pollution. I think air pollution has been a very strong way for certain citizens groups to bring court cases and to show that the government is not protecting the health of citizens as they are bound to do, for example, under WHO guidelines or other responsibilities. And I think those concrete actions or concrete effects on people are much stronger from a wider group of citizens than something like ecocide, which is quite difficult to define. And I think for most people at the moment is probably not something that they understand.
That makes sense. If we look a little bit into the future, based on trends that we're seeing today, and perhaps also driven by horrific environmental impacts in places like Syria, Yemen, as well as Ukraine, which we've talked quite a bit about today, which we really only recently started to acknowledge on a wider scale. We've kind of talked about different levels from the individual all the way to governments. How do you think accountability for environmental crimes will change in the next 5 to 10 years, if at all you see any progress in this field?
That's a very difficult question to answer. I mean, we can see that by the end of this year, we will have the UN guidelines in place. So there will be something which countries should ascribe to when waging war, and that's a concrete change. In terms of environmental crimes, I still think the world is struggling to get to grips with the biodiversity crisis. The climate crisis is on people's minds. And even if the moment in terms of the Russian invasion of Ukraine, energy security is pushing its way to the fore, and people sometimes are struggling to make the links between the need to reduce emissions and keep the lights on and make sure that people can pay their energy bills. The biodiversity, there's a parallel process to the COPs for climate, which is the COPs for biodiversity. COP 15 will be held in Canada in December after being pushed back a couple of years because of COVID. These events still get a lot less coverage than the COPs do. I think if you ask the general public, there are very few people who actually realize there's a sort of parallel process happening. So I would hope that in terms of accountability for environmental crimes, that will change in the coming years, and that the UN guidelines will at least be a starting point for that to happen. But I think there's a lot more needs to be done by governments to place the emphasis that we have two crises and that they need to be tackled together. So the environment and the climate, we can't solve or manage climate change, reduce emissions if we don't also deal with the environment, protect the environment much better and bring people to justice or bring court cases or make sure that environmental crimes are not happening in the first place.
Thanks for that, Filippa. Do you allow me a spontaneous last question? You can see if you want to answer it or not, just because it came to me. The UN has come up with these guidelines and it's working for a very long time already in putting together these principles for environmental law. Do you think that the UN is a main player in this arena, or it's simply one of the players and actually maybe civil society would have a stronger say? Who do you think is supposed to lead in this? Or is it a joint effort? Like, how do you feel about this?
I mean, I think it's a joint effort. It's something that everybody needs to work on. I think the UN has proven, both in terms of Ukraine and to a certain degree in terms of the climate crisis, that it's not a particularly strong body at the moment. However, having said that, I think Antonio Guterres, who's the head of the UN, is an extremely strong speaker on climate change, on environmental protection. He never shies away when he speaks of mentioning the real existential risks that will happen if we don't tackle climate change. He's very clear in terms of the dangers and the very narrow window we have to protect the environment and to manage climate change. So I think he's a very, very strong voice. But I think the institution as a whole, it's not a good moment for these big intergovernmental international organizations to deal with, I think, the challenges that are facing us. They were set up after the Second World War, and I think at the moment it's proving very difficult because of other geopolitical issues to get everybody to work together on issues like climate. I mean, perhaps the most recent example is China. After the US allowed Nancy Pelosi to visit Taiwan, China said, you know, it would stop bilateral climate talks with the US. So however much these institutions are trying to focus on the big issues of the day and move the agenda forward, there is a lot of other geopolitical stakes at play which make this very difficult to manage.
If I may then pop in with one other question before we move forward. I think it's something you've probably already, or you have already hinted on a bit, but in terms, we've talked quite a bit about the difficulties of protecting the environment during war. In terms of after war and you see all the damages, would this potentially be a better role for these international organizations that have trouble acting sometimes, stepping in and being more involved in the cleanup afterwards, so to say? Or is this something that we already see happening right now?
I mean, I think, as I mentioned, you know, there are precedents for this, such as the after the Iraq war. But one of the issues, obviously, here is that Russia is part of the UN Security Council, so they would have to be in favour of putting measures on themselves. A lawyer I spoke to suggested, for example, the International Criminal Court could investigate war crimes. Russian assets, for example, that are frozen could be used potentially to provide compensation for environmental and other damages that Russia has caused during its invasion of Ukraine. But I think at the moment there isn't a clear sort of one-stop solution to the problem that you just raised.
Thank you very much. Thanks also for getting into these additional questions, Filippa.
You're welcome.
We spoke with Filippa Nuttall about the impacts of war and conflict on nature and about what can and is being done in the realm of international environmental law to counteract these issues. She told us about how the weaponization of the environment in Ukraine has already started in 2014, where pollution was a pre-existing problem, with this being aggravated by bombings and heavy metal pollution. But since Russia's invasion in February 2022, shelling of infrastructure and industrial sites has severely worsened the situation. She also told us about how the Ukraine is a haven for rare birds, mammals, and migratory species, and contains protected wetlands that are crucial for Europe's environment, and about the fact that active battles are ongoing in many of these sites. Filippa spoke about the concept of eco-war and how it's being picked up by the international community to incorporate principles of environmental law. We've asked her about whether she thought there are synergies between reparations for the environmental impacts of war and the wider loss and damage claims that are permeating the climate community ahead of COP27. For her, these claims should be kept separate from each other, as historic responsibilities cannot be dealt on the same level as active war and conflict. And instead of helping move the already complex loss and damage conversation forward, it might end up hindering much-needed advancements in this area. Filippa also spoke about how environmental law is slowly developing in the UN system, including in defining concepts, principles, and guidelines, but also what role civil society plays in bringing the conversation forward and supporting accountability of governments and organizations for the environmental damage that they cause. So this was the Climate Diplomacy Podcast, and we will be back with another episode in a few weeks. Thank you so much, Filippa, for joining us.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It was a pleasure.
Yes, follow our latest updates on Twitter at Climate Diplo for upcoming episodes. And thank you for tuning in. And until next time, goodbye.